Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Craig Rimmerman. Rimmerman is a professor of public policy studies and political science at Hobart William Smith Colleges. He's the author of several books, including The New Citizenship, Unconventional Politics, Activism, and Service, released by Westview Press in its third edition this year. Welcome to the show, Craig.
Thanks, Tish. It's great to be here.
Listen, I want to start the show by having you define the new citizenship. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I have in mind is a very broad conception of what it means to be a citizen in a so-called democracy. So this would include people who engage in grassroots mobilization in their communities as well as in their workplace, engage in some form of service in which they might make a contribution to the community in that way, and that raises interesting questions about how that service experience might connect to public participation in a democracy, as well as participation through organizing on the internet, as we saw most recently in the last presidential campaign, and we see groups on the left and right doing a really good job of using the internet now in order to mobilize people on behalf of their issues and causes. So it's a very broad conception of citizenship, and I want to transcend merely thinking about politics as voting in periodic elections every 2 or 4 years, although
yeah.
that's important too, but
yeah,
that's just the least of what we're talking
yeah.
about here.
So what role does citizenry play in the political system, and what should they play? That's one of the gist of your book.
Right. I'm trying to grapple with larger questions of how the system was set up over 200 years
mm-hmm.
ago,
mm-hmm.
and I argue early on that the system was actually set up to contain democracy, to ensure that ordinary citizens did not and could not participate in meaningful ways in our political system, and that the system has continued to manifest itself in the same way over time, despite the fact that people have challenged through various social movements all kinds of impediments to the right to vote and to participation
mm-hmm.
in more meaningful ways in the workplace, in communities, and so forth. So one of the things that I'm trying to also interrogate is the connection between conventional politics, working within the formal political process, and unconventional politics. By that I mean an awful lot of the kind of protest activities that we see in various social movement groups, historically looking at the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement, the lesbian and gay movements, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So we actually do need to keep in mind that, you know, the good of the individual and the good of the community are often entirely different things, especially when you're talking about a democracy with 290 million people in it
right now
at this point.
And that's one of the challenges, of course, is how do you have a meaningful democracy when you have a territory as large as the United States of America? We have a long tradition in this country, despite what I said earlier about restrictions and barriers mm-hmm. to people participating. We still have a long tradition of people getting involved in their communities in all sorts of important and meaningful ways, as well as in the workplace. And that's the tradition that I try to build on in this book
mm-hmm.
and to try to get people to think about issues of Democrat theory and practice in hopefully profound ways. And as you know, it's targeted in many ways to college students.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to situate how young people might think about politics within these broader themes that I've already outlined to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you say to students who say that their vote doesn't count and it doesn't matter if I get involved? I hear so much cynicism.
Yeah, and that's something I can't tackle in one day of a class
mm-hmm.
or in
mm-hmm.
one conversation with
Absolutely.
A group of students.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that in my own courses at Hobart and William Smith, I try to give them an opportunity to reflect on over the course of a semester.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to probe that cynicism. Why do you feel this way? What are the forces at work that allow you to feel so disempowered in a country that calls itself a democracy? And it doesn't have to be this way. That's a message I try to send to them as well. And they need to think about, as do I, various ways that people can access the broader political system that goes beyond conventional politics and merely the vote, although the vote is important, as we've learned in the 2000 election as well as
oh,
the
absolutely.
2004 election.
Absolutely. Do you think some of the celebrity culture that we're experiencing in the last 10, 15, 20 years is hurting this? Because a lot of people who are elected to office are on high to so many people. I've heard mm-hmm. people say, oh, I can't get in touch with my representative. I don't want to bother him or her. You know, it almost seems like celebrity culture has gotten in the way of political discourse in this country.
Well, it's not just that. I think that's one part of it. But I also think there's a tradition of allowing people in positions of power, who we refer to as elites, to make decisions supposedly in our interest. Now, if you raise questions about who these people are, where they come from, what are their voting records, what are they likely to do with the power that they have, and how do you hold these people accountable? Those are really important questions that any democracy has to tackle and interrogate. And I would think in 2005 now, with the war in Iraq going on in the way that it is, with a variety of moves over the last 6-7 years in this country towards the right, that citizens, regardless of their political ideology, would want to be questioning all of these sorts of things. And so how do you get people to question what their role is in a political system that calls itself a democracy, and try and challenge this kind of cynicism?
And how do they put the answers to the questions in some kind of context that would be meaningful as well, right?
That's right, especially for people who don't have the privilege of being in the kind of privileged environment that I'm in, a small liberal arts institution where I get a chance to interact with students and colleagues on a day-to-day basis. But the thing is, there are an awful lot of people, you just look at what's going on in Ithaca, New York, where people go out into the community and do all kinds of really interesting organizing work. Sometimes it always doesn't work, as we've seen with what recently happened at Cornell and the parking situation up there
Red
and
Bud destroyed Woods.
Redbud Woods, right. But I would imagine that people in positions of power now at Cornell are going to be hopefully more vigilant as they make decisions that people perceive in this community have adverse implications for the environment and the community in which we live.
And actually, that whole issue brought some surprising parts of our community together. Faculty, community members, and city government. It's quite an amazing thing. We're going to tackle that in a show in the future.
Oh, great.
Do you think that the decision by the Supreme Court in 2000 to place George Bush in the presidency, even though Al Gore won the popular vote, has added to the cynicism?
It certainly didn't help matters. And, you know, that entire situation was very unfortunate. You might have noticed in my book, when I referred to the 2000 election and talked about Bush winning, I always put that in quote marks.
Yes.
Because, understandably, it was very much a contested process. And it broke down to a political decision by the United States Supreme Court. And how soon we forgot that, it seemed to me, and how soon the Democratic Party forgot that after the 2000 election. And the entire way that election was decided, as well as questions raised about voting irregularities in the most recent election, most notably in my home state of Ohio, raises questions about how we do the very basic elements of democracy, whether people, when they go to the polls, feel that they can honestly and fairly cast their right to vote and have it be counted in a way that we would think would be appropriate for a democratic political system. How ironic it is that we've been critical of other countries over the years for not being able to run fair elections, but I think these last two elections, especially 2000, raise serious questions about whether we can conduct fair and open and legal elections of our own.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any analysis about why there wasn't more protest? Why a senator didn't stand up in 2000 and protest this so that they could go back and reanalyze it and not exactly let it happen?
My sense is that people just wanted to move forward in the interest of the country.
It was a long haul.
It was a real long haul, and I greatly admire the members of the House of Representatives who stood before the American people in the well of their chamber on that day when the ballots were counted to formally elect President Bush and protested this. And I hope, unfortunately, that didn't get an awful lot of news coverage. Of course, Michael Moore begins his latest film with that vignette, and it's a very,
right.
very powerful moment, I think.
Yeah, it was shocking to a lot of people.
That's right, and I'm just glad that an awful lot of people had the opportunity to see that, because it really does raise questions about our fundamental right to vote. But as you know, my book's about the vote and much more.
Oh, absolutely. So how has the internet changed things for good and for better and for worse, in your opinion?
Well, it's interesting. In the last election, of course, John Kerry felt compelled to announce his choice of the VP running mate, John Edwards, on the internet first to his supporters. Mm-hmm. So everyone found out that way an hour before it was made public to the rest of the country. And that is an indication and a signal of the powerful importance of the internet in contemporary American politics. Mm-hmm. Howard Dean did a fantastic thing by using organizing through the internet, and this during the Democrat primary mm-hmm. season, and it helped catapult him. Not only has got much more name recognition, got an awful lot of publicity, and got a lot of grassroots organizing by using the meetup.org website,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and also the moveon.org website, and their organizing efforts on a wide array of issues has been quite impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the implications of all this are that we're going to see candidates down the road recognize the importance of using the internet as a valuable organizing tool. Now, those are just mainstream politicians.
Mm-hmm.
On both the left and the right, you see people organizing in meaningful ways through the internet as a way to reach as many people as possible. In what many people would consider to be fundamentally democratic ways. The problem with that is potentially not everyone has access to the internet,
mm-hmm.
but increasingly that barrier is being broken down in various places.
Mm-hmm.
And you can literally communicate with people politically across the world if you're trying to organize people. And this is something that protesters and organizers in the 1950s and the 60s in the United States of America didn't have access to. So it's helped to change the face of community organizing and national level organizing mm-hmm. in really important ways.
It's also changed the way people run political campaigns.
Absolutely.
Because you don't waste as much time. You used to have face-to-face meetings even to write speeches with your team. Now people are sending copies of speeches back and forth on emails. It's really quite remarkable.
Now I have to say though, there is, if I don't know if you detected it, I talk about Rousseau in this book just a little bit. I have a Rousseauian strain, and what that means to me is there's nothing better than sitting down with a group of people face to face and having meaningful conversations that matter to us.
I agree.
And I am very lucky to be able to do that in a classroom setting, and I think it's important and not always easy mm-hmm. to approximate the same thing out in the community and in the workplace where most people spend most of their lives.
Mm-hmm. And then that's what I like about this show, that we can actually sit here and talk. We don't have to talk on the phone.
That's
or
right.
Sit here with Mickey Mouse earphones on.
That's right.
What do you think the anger-infested talk radio situation in this country is taking us in regard to bringing people together?
What's that?
If we're that with sarcasm.
Yeah, I know. Especially if you're using anger in the same sentence as bringing people together. Let me tell you something. One of my students once quoted Rush Limbaugh in a paper, and that never happened again. And I make a point of it. That is not a source of substantiation for an argument as far as I'm concerned. I actually think shows of that nature, and the right have been very successful mm-hmm. in propagating these shows and getting certain messages across. I believe that talk radio, as well as some of these television shows, which I don't watch at all and don't listen to these talk radio mm-hmm. shows, have poisoned the environment in all sorts of ways. One way they've poisoned the environment is they've distracted us from trying to get a better understanding of the issues of the day. I tell my students all the time that they would be better off to turn off television, not to watch the Bill O'Reilly Show and programs of this nature,
mm-hmm.
Not listen to these kind of vulgar radio programs, and instead try and read a good newspaper every day, more than one,
mm-hmm.
Read good journals of public opinion across mm-hmm. the ideological divide. So often, even though I don't share this ideology, I'll walk into a classroom and say, okay, you should look at the American Conservative. You should look at the Weekly Standard, as well as look at The Nation. You should look at In These Times. You should look at Dissent, The New Republic, all of these publications mm-hmm. as much mm-hmm. as possible.
I think a lot of people have lost sight of the fact that a lot of these talk shows are opinion and not fact.
And they're also very much organized around the personality who's driving these shows, right? The person in charge, the talk show host, mm-hmm. himself or herself. And one reality check, though, is, and I made reference to this earlier, the right has done a very good job of using these shows as a vehicle to get their ideas across.
Mm-hmm.
And the political left has got to figure out a way to counter this. Mm-hmm. And slowly but surely. But I don't think that that is a replacement for the kind of grassroots, community-based, workplace organizing, democratic movements that I extol in the book.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. The voter turnout in most of the Western countries besides the United States is so much higher. Why do you think that is? Is it a different education system in regard to making sure people participate? Or
Let me answer your question with a little vignette. When I walk into my introductory level courses in public policy and political science, I ask my students, how many of you have participated in some kind of service activity before you've come to Hobart Williams-Smith? And almost everyone says they've done this, right? As high school students or junior high, right before they've come to college, they've done this. Then I ask them the question, how many of you have a good understanding of the American political system and the policy process? And I would say maybe a quarter of the same hands are raised. And I've been trying to figure out that tension. Why is it that all of these young people who at one point or another in their lives, before they've come to college, have participated in some kind of service project vis-a-vis their community, at the same time, many of these same people have very little understanding of the American political system and the policy process in which we live in a country that calls itself a democracy. So, and I try and tease that out of them, and they're very honest with me in saying that we failed at the junior high and high school public education system in many cases. But it's a broader set of phenomena than that. I think that in many ways, we are discouraged to participate in the political system in meaningful ways, and that people look at the choices that we are given in mainstream American politics, and they don't see many differences in many cases between the major party candidates, mm-hmm. and the nastiness and the unfortunate inability to discuss issues in serious and meaningful ways. For example, we could imagine a campaign in which you discuss the future of the planet, and had thoughtful people running for office discuss environmental issues from a global perspective and not just look at things from the American ethnocentric vantage point. I know my students like to talk about that. I know people in the community that I interact with want to talk about those things as well.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Professor Craig Rimmerman. I want to ask you what you think September 11th did to this country, if anything. Everybody was talking right afterwards that this will bring the communities together. Has it?
At the outset, right after September 11th, I think that there was quite a bit of people trying to transcend differences in their political and social and economic perspectives on the world to try and come together to make sense of what had happened on our own soil. After all, we had never experienced something like this before, unlike other allied countries in Europe and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I do think it was quite unfortunate, and I talk about this in the book, that one of President Bush's first responses is the best thing that you can do in response to September 11th is you can help our economy along by going shopping.
Yeah, I remember.
And, you know, the American people wanted to do an awful lot more. I know that I had been invited that week to a dinner and to give a talk and lead a discussion at a fraternity house on campus. And so we canceled the topic. I had been invited to come in and talk about the lesbian and gay movements to this group of young men by a very courageous and wonderful student of mine. And when I got there, you know, September 11th had happened a couple of days before, so we talked about all of this. And what struck me was the response of this room of maybe 20, 25 young men all wanted to do something in response. What do you think, Professor? Could we go down to New York? You know, we're strong. We can lend a hand. And at that point, people were saying it would be better if people stayed away because there's so many people going down to New York for the relief efforts and so forth. But what I was struck by was the real passion and commitment on the part of these young people that they absolutely wanted to do something more than going shopping, let me assure you. And I thought that spirit is something that we need to build on. And so we're not thinking of it only in the context of a disaster, but instead trying to build that spirit into our daily lives as we interact with one another in all realms of our lives.
And it's too bad our leaders weren't able to build on that at the moment when they were so ready. So do you think So afterwards, you felt people wanted to do something and were in that spirit of wanting to help the community, but it has dissipated, don't you agree?
That's more of a complicated question because, you know, we would have to look at various avenues as to see. Mm-hmm. If you say it's dissipated, it may well be because of conflict around various political issues, an understandable mm-hmm. conflict, mm-hmm. given how this president came to power in 2000 and how they've governed since. That's mm-hmm. the key thing, mm-hmm. right? What I always tell people is, well, they certainly didn't govern as someone who got elected in a highly contested and questionable manner.
Absolutely.
There were quotes by Cheney in a variety of places that have since been released saying, we won this election and we are going to push the hard right conservative agenda. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. from my vantage point, I believe they've done that, and they've done that quite well. And the political left needs to learn from the right about how to better organize at the grassroots in all walks of life.
So one of your themes in this book is that people need to be educated to be citizens. They're not born citizens, correct?
That's right.
So where do we go from here then? You think they should start teaching children in early grades a lot more about being a citizen?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and in many ways, by the time I get students, right, they're 18, 19 years old, it's far too late, right? It's an embarrassing situation when a group of highly mobile and motivated young people, in a lot of ways elite students going to a small privileged liberal arts school like ours at Hobart William Smith, when they say they don't understand anything about their political system. What's going on here?
That's unbelievable.
You know, this is, and it may well be laziness on their part, right? It also, though, I think stems from an inability to teach an awful lot of these young people about the political system in interesting, open, and critical ways, so they have an opportunity to reflect on some of the issues that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I try and do both in the book as well as in my own classes is to make sure that students who disagree with me will feel that they have an opportunity to share an informed, thoughtful response in response to the arguments that I'm making. And I think an awful lot of people perceive that in the larger society, they don't have that opportunity. Things are so terribly polarized mm-hmm. that we don't have the opportunity to have the kind of quality discourse that I associate with this concept, the new citizenship, and that I would like to see put into practice. My hope is, of course, is that anyone who would take classes with people like me that are raising these issues, and by the way, I'm not the only one who does this by any stretch of the imagination. There are plenty of people at the junior high and high school level who are trying to do this, but have to fight against school boards and communities, and it's much more difficult for
them.
I
mean, controversy.
Right, in areas of the country, and that's right, all of this sort of thing. It's not an easy thing. I always do, when I meet high school or junior high or grade school teachers, I say, you are doing the tough work. Thank you for all the work that you're doing mm-hmm. on behalf of educating young people, so that when I get them, hopefully that they're engaged enough that they're willing to talk about these issues in serious and meaningful ways.
Mm-hmm. So do you think a lot of students are afraid to bring up issues because they have probably been slapped down or told not to talk about controversy, you know?
I'm sure. No, I'm sure that's the case. And part of what we face, and it's not just in an educational setting, you know, there are an awful lot of people who, given their class background, their economic background, aren't going to be able to get to a college setting. So how do you then instill these values and opportunities for meaningful participation outside the educational setting, beyond, you know, when someone graduates from high school, assuming that they do? Mm-hmm. How do you build that into people's lives? And of course, when people are economically living at the margins, when they're worried about whether they're going to have a roof over their head or health care, right, or food on the table, it becomes much more difficult for those people to participate in the way that I'm talking about, because to go out to community meetings, of course, it takes time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And people still think one individual can't make a difference, even though we have so much evidence to the contrary. People like Rosa Parks and now Cindy Sheehan has resurrected in some ways the anti-war movement. So one person can make a difference. I don't know how you teach that.
Well, and you know, this Cindy Sheehan case is quite interesting because one of the reasons that she's getting this attention, I mean, the media started out a little bit slowly, but now it's broken into the national press. So you need to be able to come up with some kind of organizing vehicle that you're going to capture the media's attention to get your message out. Mm-hmm. That's a crucial element of any kind of political organizing. Mm-hmm. And it will be very interesting to see how this all plays out. It certainly is not helping support for the war. There's no doubt about it, and with good reason, mm-hmm. given the way that this war has progressed and is progressing at the current time.
Mm-hmm. And also the justification for it has changed.
Well, there was never a clear justification. I mean, the competing goals and not well thought out. Even, and I talked to an awful lot of people who supported this war effort at the outset. That's one of the things I try and do, is reach out to people who I know are very thoughtful and who I'm likely to disagree with, to try and get an understanding of their rationale. And even if you agreed that this war made sense to get Saddam Hussein from power, I think you would have to at this point say that Bush, Rumsfeld, and the entire Bush administration have done a terrible job in implementing it. There wasn't much time devoted to what the reconstruction effort would look like once he left power. And there have been way too many deaths on the Iraqi side. We don't fully know how many.
Oh, yeah.
And the deaths among our own troops are understandably increasingly being difficult for the public to accept.
Mm-hmm. What are your hopes for the future in regard to this citizenship?
Well, I'm a very hopeful person. I think you have to be.
Yeah.
If you're working with young people and trying to inspire them to think about politics and the political system in different ways. And I know it's a cliche, but I really do believe that young people, right, in their teens and in their 20s now, are people that we've got to turn to for leadership, for new ideas, for organizing, and all of those sorts of things. And I think that in some ways for the political left, perhaps, and I you know, don't want to make this argument too strongly, and there's certainly a viable critique of it, but it may well be that this Bush administration has been a real wake-up call, that what we are experiencing in this country right now since he and Cheney took power, as well as the Congress controlled by Republicans, is a kind of nastiness and partisanship and a strong rightward tilt throughout the country in a way that is going to prove to be very offensive to an awful lot of Americans. The vote is one vehicle to combat that, but there are other vehicles that I talk about in this book in terms of community organizing, workplace organizing, speaking out, engaging in acts of courage and resistance, and I'm not here to say what those are. People have to decide mm-hmm. when they feel comfortable to find their own critical voice to engage in those acts, and hopefully that can be more often than less often. And I realize in this day and age of crackdowns on civil liberties and civil rights across the board in the United States. Who would have ever thought that in the United States of America we would have to worry about those sorts of things on the kind of scale that we are right now?
At this point in time,
That people will somehow develop that kind of courage to work with other people to organize on behalf of change. And, you know, I spent a lot of time talking about the civil rights movement, the African-American civil mm-hmm. rights movement in that book, as a kind of historical juncture for everything. And I want people who read it to come away with an understanding of how people organized in very vital, vibrant, and crucial ways at an important time in our history. And so that movements of today can build on those successes and those strategies and work to avoid the weaknesses associated with some of the mistakes they made.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about the gay movement as well, right?
Yes.
I mean, it seems to me people need to feel that they need to save their own lives in order to really be galvanized and
that's
passionate.
Right. And I think, you know, I do an awful lot on social movements in my writing as well as in what I teach, and looking at a variety of these movements that I mentioned earlier, the environmental movement, the women's movement, the African-American civil rights movement, and certainly the lesbian and gay movements, gives us some insight as to how people at the margins of American society have worked with other people, and that's crucial, worked with mm-hmm. other people, mm-hmm. found some kind of empowerment, some sense of mobilization in a way where they could link their own personal private concerns with a larger public purpose. And we need that desperately at all levels of the political system, in our workplaces, and in the society and the communities where we live and work.
Mm-hmm. Craig Rimmerman, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for being
goodness.
With us.
I wish we had more time. Thank you, and thank you to you for all the work you're doing on behalf of the new citizenship, Tish.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Craig.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at WEOS at hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.